Welcome to the Boulder Nutrition Think Tank. This program was recorded in June of 2004. It's part two of the first session with Ron Rosedale. In this part two, he explains why he believes that a high-fat diet works. But first, if these programs are new to you, I'm Shelley Schlender, a member of the Think Tank, which was launched in the summer of 2004 to educate people about how to reduce the risk of, or even reverse, chronic conditions such as obesity, heart disease, and diabetes. Sessions were held at the Family Learning Center in Boulder, whose mission is to promote self-sufficiency for families of diverse cultures and limited income. For our nutritional approach, we chose a low-carb, adequate protein, high-fat diet. While there's increasing scientific evidence for this eating style, there's little government support for low-carb programs, making them hard for people with limited incomes to try. That's one reason we wanted to explore developing a program like this. Ron Rosedale is a Denver medical doctor who led many discussions about the science of nutrition, health, and low-carb, high-fat diets. Up next, Ron Rosedale explains the science behind his approach to nutrition and health.
There's two major diets right now duking it out. For a long time, it was a high-carbohydrate, low-saturated fat diet. I mean, that's been kind of the mantra of the medical profession, American Heart Association, American Diabetes Association, for a long time. And over the last few years, finally, it's come under question. And the question was raised then really by a low-carb, high-protein diet, or a low-carb, anything-else-goes diet. And on this show, I was supposed to be the advocate for that diet. And they thought me, you know, it was a national, big national show. So they had somebody who was advocating a high-carb diet, and I was supposed to be advocating a low-carbohydrate Atkins-type diet. And basically I said, well, they're actually both wrong. And some of the major confusion is coming about because neither one is right. And the diet I recommend is a bit different than both of those, and I'll tell you about that. I think the main reason that there's so much confusion from diet is because there have been literally thousands of books written about diet and health. They'll say, do this to be healthy. To, you know, cardiologists, you need to lower your cholesterol to be healthy, and you'll get a particular definition of health from a chiropractor or from an MD or from a gastroenterologist or a neurologist. It doesn't make any difference. The fact remains that if you asked 1,000 different health professionals what health is, you're going to get 1,000 different answers. And so if they say, do this to be healthy, the confusion arises is because they have a different viewpoint of health than you do, or than I do. There's no common denominator. And so if you have no common destination, how can they tell you accurately how to get there? To a cardiologist, they'll say, health is having as low a cholesterol as you possibly can. So for them, being on cholesterol-lowering drugs will make you healthy. And they would be right if you go by their definition, because cholesterol-lowering drugs lower cholesterol. And if cholesterol-lowering gets you healthy, then they would be correct. But that, of course, begs the question, is health really low cholesterol? So what really needs to be defined then is, what is health? I mean, what are we really trying to achieve? And you really have to know your destination before you can ever know how to get there. And that's one of the things we're going to be talking about, because I don't want there to be very much confusion as to what our destination is. And only when we know that can I accurately then tell you how to get there via nutrition. And I think you'll understand then why nutrition then is really so powerful. I believe that you can accomplish more by changing your diet and maybe a few supplements than any combination of drugs or surgery could ever even dream of accomplishing. And I think you'll understand that by the end of the day, I hope. So what is health? That's not such an easy question. I mean, I've been thinking about that question for, you know, a long time. And first of all, you have to understand, when you say, well, what is health? When I say, what will make me healthy? Or what will make you healthy? Again, you can't take too many things for granted. What do I mean when I say me or you? What is you? And this is more than just a pedantic question. You are not what you think you are. You are actually 10 trillion lives. It's fairly well accepted that the basic fundamental unit of life is the individual cell. I mean, the cell theory of life has pretty well been accepted, that each individual cell is a living entity. And you've got about 10 trillion of them, each one trying to live its own life, but also trying to be part of a community. It's like a beehive or an ant colony. There's a society. You're really a republic of cells. And it is that republic that you're trying to keep alive. I mean, cells come and go. You got a bunch of dead cells in you right now. And you're going to hopefully renew most of those. You've got almost as many dead cells as alive cells. You've got a whole bunch of lives living in your gut. There's so-called, you know, normal bacterial flora, and I'm sure some abnormal bacterial flora that you could not live without. You'd be dead if you didn't have those very important bacteria living in your gut. And in a healthy person, there's at least 3 times as many bacteria living in your gut than comprise the cells that normally would be considered to make up your own body. Yet we don't consider them part of our body. And every time you go to the bathroom, you excrete some of those, and hopefully you'll eat some more when you have some food, and they keep multiplying. So our life is really a republic of many different lives, considered part of ourselves and not part of ourselves. We breathe. Why do we breathe? We take in oxygen. We need oxygen to burn food. Where do we get that oxygen? We use our lungs to process that oxygen, and that oxygen comes from plants. Our lungs would be worthless without plants. We could not live without plants. Plants do very well without us, but we couldn't live without plants. We'd be useless. And so there's a scientific argument that's also fairly well accepted that plants are really like an external organ. They manufacture a vital nutrient that we can't live without. So where does our life begin? Where does it end? That's not such an easy question, actually. We talk about being healthy. That means, at least fundamentally, to be healthy, you have to be alive. Right? I mean, it's hard to call a dead person healthy. Now, that might not be sufficient, but certainly something fundamental to being healthy is to staying alive. And again, that begs the question, what is that? That seems real simple. But if we want to keep you alive, we have to know what life is. And that's actually a question that has been brought forth over the decades to many Nobel laureates. It's never been answered. Nobody knows what life is. You think you know. You have kind of a gut feeling, as it were, what life is. But it's a very difficult thing to answer. And that gets into some pretty deep physics that we won't go into now. But it can actually be answered. But it really amounts to not individual things, you know, not individual entities. It amounts to information. What we're trying to keep alive is the information that tells our cells what to do to act in a coordinated manner so that we believe we are a single, well-functioning, healthy individual. And that's really what life is. Life is in the instructions. It is the organization. It is the prevention of chaos that we're trying to help. We need instructions. Cells constantly have to be told what to do. Otherwise, they're going to go off on their own. So they're constantly getting instructions. Every millisecond, they're getting thousands of messages from hormones. And that's how cells communicate. They communicate via chemical messengers that they read via Braille. The shape of those messengers tells those cells what to do. It'll tell a heart cell to keep pumping, or a skin cell to keep external poisons out. It tells each cell to be what it is. Every cell in your body has the identical genetic structure. Your heart cells have the same genes as your kidney cells, has the same genes as your skin cells. The only difference are the so-called gametes. You know, your sperm and eggs have a bit of a different genetic apparatus. Every other cell in your body has the same genes. Now, why is that important? Because they're not all the same. Obviously, a heart cell is not the same as a kidney cell. It's not the same as a skin cell. And yet, they have the exact same genes. Now, there's a point that I'm trying to make on this, that it is not the genes that makes them different. It is the expression of the genes, because not all genes are read. Only a small fraction of the genes are being read. The genetic expression is what will make a heart cell, and make it beat, or a skin cell. It is the genetic expression that is important. So you hear diabetes is a genetic disease, or my parents had diabetes. All of my family was fat. Therefore, I'm doomed. I'm going to get fat, I'm going to get diabetes, I'm going to get breast cancer or heart disease, because I've been told by my doctors that they measured my genes, which you can do now. And I know I'm just thinking of a patient right now who I was told yesterday was having a bilateral mastectomy because she was told she had the genes that would predispose her to breast cancer. So she's having a preventive bilateral mastectomy. What I want you to understand, it is not so much your genes that are important, it is the expression of those genes. And we're finding that they can be expressed or they can remain dormant. And what will cause genes to be expressed or not expressed are the messages that that cell is getting. If it gets messages that that cell should become diabetic, it'll become diabetic. If it gets messages that it should burn fat and doesn't need sugar, it's going to stay healthy. So it's messages, which, you know, you can consider your genetic apparatus like a library of books. And all of the knowledge that has been accumulated from the history of life, thousands, millions, billions of years, depending on your point of view, has been accumulated in this library. But we don't need it all now. So we have most of those books just laying dormant. We only use a fraction, maybe a few percent of the genes. We know, for instance, that we have 99.7 or something like that percent identical genes to a chimpanzee. We have 70% homology of genes to a worm. But obviously there's big differences between a chimpanzee and a human. But it doesn't lie so much in the difference in our genes. Our genes are almost the same. The expression of those genes is different. Just like the expression of genes of a heart cell versus a kidney cell. Even though in a particular person they are identical. We can alter genetic expression. And you alter genetic expression via the environment that that cell finds itself in. Via the different instructions. Via the different nutritional environment. We know if you subject many different types of life forms to a famine, they're going to want to try and exist. Everything that you see in the universe today is trying to do the same thing, and that is to exist. Just trying to be. It's trying to remain alive, you might say. And those that are best at it do. So everything you see out there has learned how to cope with a very hazardous universe. Organisms that are subjected to famine might turn into a spore. And they found spores that are millions of years old that can then germinate into life. They found seeds of lotus plants that were over 10,000 years old that they planted and grew lotus plants. There's a bacteria that was found that was anywhere between 25 million and 250 million years old. It basically desiccated itself to try and survive a very salty environment. And it does so by changing its genetic expression. It appears that over the years, every organism, every type of life has the knowledge on how to live a much longer, healthier life. Because nature wants us to reproduce. Nature wants the information on how to make life persist to persist. So, for instance, if it's not a good time to reproduce now. Nature has endowed, it appears, every living organism with the knowledge of how to stay alive longer, so that that organism can reproduce at a future, more opportune time. Geneticists and researchers studying the biology of aging are utilizing this knowledge, and they have for about 10 years, and they're able to do really remarkable things. They've been able to tweak the genes of virtually every organism that they try to live between 30 and 600% longer. The equivalent of a human living to be perhaps 800 years old. They're able to make worms and flies and yeast, the common laboratory rats. And they're even able to make rats. They've made mice now, the Methuselah, I think. There's a prize called the Methuselah Prize, and it goes to the researcher who's able to keep an organism alive the longest. Went to a friend of mine, Andre Bartke, that we just had a chat with the other day in Florida, and he was able to keep a mouse alive four times its normal lifespan, like a human living to be 500 years old. So there's things that the general public doesn't know that is commonplace knowledge to laboratory researchers. And again, the common denominator is that we have the genetic apparatus that allows us to do that, given the right nutritional environment. Now let's talk about sugar and insulin. If you go to your doctor will say that the purpose of insulin is to regulate blood sugar. You'll hear that from the top people in the world. And it is not true. In fact, it's very far from the truth. The purpose of insulin almost has nothing to do with regulating blood sugar. There is a theory about aging called the disposable soma theory. And among experts in the biology of aging, it's really no longer a theory. It's pretty well accepted as fact as you can get. And it states that there's basically two lives within each of us. You've got the so-called soma, which you think of as yourself, and then you've got your germ line, your germ cells, your sperm and your egg. And the disposable soma says that we're here just to temporarily take care of that precious information that houses the information on how to make life. And our purpose is to perpetuate that information. Keep those genes healthy. Keep the germ cells healthy so that you can reproduce. And that life has remained alive ever since the very first cell. It was a cell, and it divided and divided and continued to get more and more complex, found more and more ways to survive in a very hazardous world until it made complex beings like us that are still there to see to it that our germ cells continue to divide. It has remained immortal. We then become dispensable. In other words, nature cares about the preservation of the information of life, and we're just there to take temporary care of that information. And once we've been given an opportunity to do that, we become dispensable, which is why we age and die. In other words, why do we have to die? Some organisms don't. Some organisms are immortal as far as we know. What's the real purpose of aging and dying? And that's what it is. It's because we can age so that our germ cells don't. And we have a certain amount of energy that can be directed towards reproduction and the perpetuation of that germline, or maintenance and repair. We have to give nature a reason to keep us alive and healthy. One of the reasons would be if we encountered a famine. Now, if it's not good, it's not good to reproduce right now, why invest a whole bunch of energy into making babies if there was going to be no food around to feed it? One has to understand, we evolved in times, for the most part, that were much different than what we live in now. Food was never a guarantee. I mean, now you can go to King Soopers and buy food 24/7. That was not like it was 10,000 years ago. That's not like it was 1,000 years ago, or even a couple hundred years ago. Encountering a famine was commonplace. You never knew whether you were going to eat tomorrow or not. And it became imperative to essentially make hay while you could. So if there was a lot of food around, it was very important to eat that food. In fact, eat as much of it as you could. And store some of that energy for tomorrow, or for next week, or even for next month, because you didn't know if you were going to be able to eat. And the signal for that, apparently, is insulin. So if there's a whole lot of sugar around, and sugar was one of our first fuels, I won't go into why that's so, but we know that sugar was a fuel long before fat was. And when sugar rises in your bloodstream, it's a signal that you've got more energy than you can burn right now. That's what allows it to build up in your blood. Otherwise, you'd be burning it. And that rise in blood sugar is a signal to secrete insulin so you can store that sugar so you have fuel for tomorrow or for next week or for next month. But we only store a small amount as sugar, so our main storage is to convert that sugar into fat right now. And we use fat as our stored form of energy. So right there you have a purpose for insulin that goes beyond the control of blood sugar. It's actually the storage of energy. Yeah, I know. Good class. And so at the least, the purpose of insulin is to store energy for times of need when there is times of plenty. It goes beyond that, though. I was talking about aging and life and death and the disposable soma theory and things like that because it appears that, at least in simple organisms, insulin is a signal that will tell your body whether, or tell each individual cell, whether that cell should reproduce, that the times are plenty, there's plenty of fuel around, go ahead and reproduce now. And if so, there's no reason to have it live a really long life. Or to not reproduce now and wait, which then gives nature a reason to keep that cell alive. And when it does so, if it decides that it wants to keep you alive, it has to upregulate, increase the genetic expression of the mechanisms that allow you to stay healthy and alive. People here maybe heard of antioxidants, and each cell has antioxidant systems, but you really want to turn them on from the inside. And oxidation is good sometimes, because that's how we kill cancer, that's how we kill bacteria. So just taking global antioxidants might not be that great. It's best to turn them on when you want them, turn them off when you don't. There are things called heat shock proteins. There's all sorts of things, the DNA repair enzymes, all sorts of things that you've probably never heard of that are required to keep a cell healthy and alive. And these can be upregulated via the genes if they're given the instructions to do so. And those instructions come from hormones that tell that cell that it must increase maintenance and repair because it's not a good time to reproduce right now. And we know that in simple organisms, that signal comes from insulin. So there we've gone beyond now insulin controlling blood sugar and beyond insulin controlling the storage or use of energy into controlling the actual aging process and therefore the symptoms of aging. As we age and as we accrue damage, we get heart disease and diabetes and we start getting fat and we get autoimmune diseases and we get osteoporosis. These are symptoms of the damage that we accrue as we age. We have a constant battle between the accumulation of damage, or the occurrence of damage, I should say, and the repair of that damage. We cannot stop damage. It's built in. You've heard of antioxidants. You take antioxidants to try and prevent oxidation. Why do we oxidize? Because we are surrounded by oxygen, and we breathe it. It is almost a built-in aging mechanism. We can't tell you to not oxidize. That would require the cessation of breathing, which wouldn't be such a healthy thing. So we know we're going to oxidize. The best we can do is repair the damage that oxidation does. But we know we can actually turn up the repair mechanisms. We have to give nature a reason to do so. So insulin is receiving a lot of notoriety among the biology of aging researchers. We just went to one of the major meetings in the world on the biology of aging, and I would say, gosh, every other talk had to do with insulin. Approximately, less than 10 years ago, the first gene that was shown to modify aging was discovered. Age 1 gene, discovered by Tom Johnson, University of Colorado, who we just spoke to again. And that set off an explosion in research. Then they found a gene that, when mutated, extended the life of a worm considerably. Now, this was front page news in all the scientific journals. I mean, it was a huge finding that you could mutate one gene and a worm would stay alive 50% longer and stay healthier. You don't just get older longer, you stay younger longer. All of the diseases associated with aging were slowed down. It is as if time had slowed down for that organism. They didn't know what the mutation did. It's called the DAF2. And then Cynthia Kenyon's group at the University of California, San Francisco, discovered what that gene did, and it encoded an insulin receptor. And they continued to refine it, and now they have the entire genetic pathway that controls aging mapped out in the worm and the fly, and they're doing it now in the rodent and in yeast. And lo and behold, the really cool part is they're finding that the genes that control aging in worms and flies and yeast and rodents are identical. It is a conserved mechanism, and they're finding those same genes in humans. In other words, this mechanism to actually regulate the aging process, which regulates the symptoms associated with aging, which includes obesity and diabetes and heart disease and osteoporosis and all those things, are encoded by all the same genes. And those genes all listen to insulin. And how much insulin you have is going to determine, to a large extent, how rapidly you age and how rapidly you get the symptoms of aging. But they're finding even more, that in complex organisms like us, the storage of energy is what will dictate how rapidly you age. In other words, if there's a lot of energy that's being shown, you've got a whole bunch of energy right now, what you ought to be doing is reproducing and not living necessarily a long life. That would just get in the way. And again, your cells are told what to do by hormones. And the hormone that apparently dictates whether you reproduce or whether you should live a long, healthy life in humans appears to be a hormone called leptin, which you've probably never heard of. But you will. So you'll be one of the first to hear of this. An extremely important hormone. They're finding more and more outstanding functions of this hormone. We know that it controls osteoporosis. Keeping leptin low causes bones to build, to get stronger. It is the only known way to do that. Estrogen, Fosamax do not build bone. That is a misconception. They can help prevent the breakdown of bone. That is not the same thing. What you end up then is old, dry, brittle bones by taking Fosamax and all the drugs. Yeah. But controlling leptin allows an increase in maintenance and repair mechanisms so that you build strong bones. want to get off of cholesterol-lowering drugs? Simple. You want to get off of most high blood pressure medications? It's relatively easy. You want to reverse diabetes? It's relatively easy. But it's not going to be from a drug. And therefore, you haven't heard of it. So, to sum up what I've said so far, there are two major hormones that control the rate of aging in laboratory animals. And in humans have been shown to greatly influence the degree and prevalence of all of the so-called chronic diseases of aging. That includes heart disease, cancer, diabetes, autoimmune disease. A lot of people asked about autoimmune disease. Malfunction of the immune system. And the immune system is one of the major systems where information and knowledge and communication is really important. You want to communicate what that immune cell should be gobbling up. He wants to gobble up cancer cells and bacteria, but not gobble up yourself. When it gets confused, it starts gobbling up you. And that's an autoimmune disease. It's a definite sign of miscommunication, a failure to communicate. And I will tell you that all disease, there is no exception. Any disease, any injury, anything that deviates from perfect health is due to miscommunication. There is some sort of information that either is not getting across or is getting across that shouldn't. And that produces all disease. For some of the most severe forms of autoimmune disease, for instance, they are finding that it is preceded by a surge in leptin. Very interesting research that's fairly new. That includes multiple sclerosis. And when they kept leptin levels low, it prevented the autoimmune disease. So whether it can be then used to treat it, it's too new to know. But obviously leptin plays a big role in the immune system. We know that leptin influences the sympathetic nervous system, which influences heart rate and blood pressure. I mentioned calcium deposition in arteries, calcium deposition in bones, protein building of bones. There is no chronic disease that leptin has not been found to either strongly influence or in fact actually control. And much of the medical community is becoming aware of this. Most of it hasn't been taught to them yet. These are research articles. And they're all, you know, from different specialties. And people are amazed when they hear the different things that it does. And how can something that actually controls fat deposition, and I'll explain that in a minute, actually control bone formation, or heart disease, or cancer? You know, so many different things, autoimmune diseases. Well, the common denominator is actually it controls the genetic expression of maintenance and repair because it's actually controlling the aging process. Leptin was first discovered about 10 years ago. There was a mouse model called the OB mouse. It was a fat mouse, and it was used in a lot of experiments. You know, different drugs, different diets, mostly drugs. And it was used as a model of human obesity. They didn't know what made it fat until about 10 years ago. And they found that the reason this mouse was fat, and it was called the OB mouse for obesity, is that it lacked a hormone called leptin. And when Dr. Friedman at Rockefeller University in New York injected this mouse with leptin, it became thin and healthy and vibrant and received lots of publicity. Front page, USA Today, showed a picture of this fat mouse, and then after it received leptin, it was thin. And they figured this is the cure for obesity. And literally within days, drug companies were researching how to manufacture leptin, genetically manufacture, so they could make, you know, obesity is a big deal. And they could make trillions of dollars. So they figured they would just be the first to patent a genetic formulation of leptin before they started measuring leptin in people. Then they started measuring leptin in people, and they found out in almost all overweight people, It was not due to a lack of leptin. It was due, or not necessarily due to, but it was correlated with very high levels of leptin. So giving extra leptin didn't do anything. So they stopped them in their tracks. They knew leptin had something to do with obesity, but had no idea what to do about it. And to this day, leptin is known as the fat hormone. Leptin is produced by fat cells. And it has taken fat to new heights. Fat was considered just a nasty byproduct. People are fat, you don't want fat. But now we know that fat produces a bunch of hormones. And in fact, like your pancreas produces hormones. Your pancreas produces insulin. So it's considered an endocrine gland. Your adrenal gland produces hormones. It's considered an endocrine gland. Your fat cells produce hormones. Your fat now is considered an endocrine gland. Just like your pancreas or your adrenal glands. It produces a lot of different hormones. Leptin still probably being the most important. And what it's supposed to do, and this is revolutionizing the theory or the thinking about obesity, it is supposed to regulate your weight. It was no good to be fat in our history. It was no good to be skinny. You wanted to store some energy. Again, all of our ancestors encountered periods of famine. If you didn't store any energy, you wouldn't survive that famine. If you were fat, you actually had a better chance of surviving a longer famine. All the skinny contemporaries would have died off. There was a selective advantage to be fat and to get fat efficiently. So if you did encounter a bunch of fruit, let's say, eat that fruit, get fat quickly, so that if a tough winter hit, you'd be able to survive it. But the other side of the coin is if you became too fat, you wouldn't be able to move very quickly. And our ancestors needed to be mobile. They had to hunt. They had to run after prey. And if you were too fat, you'd be the last one there. You wouldn't get to eat. Almost self-limiting. Prevent you then from getting too fat. But more importantly, you couldn't prevent yourself from being prey. So if a lion was chasing a group of people, the fattest person was going to get caught. So then there was a selective disadvantage to being fat. And it was selected against. So there had to be signals to tell your body how much fat to store. You wanted just enough to tide you through a reasonable famine, but not so much that you couldn't run very fast. And that signal is from leptin. So what happens, what is supposed to happen, is as you get fatter, your fat cells produce leptin. It goes to your brain, and it goes to a particular center in your brain called the hypothalamus, more specifically the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus, the tiny little portion of your brain that regulates hunger. It's a powerful center. If you electronically stimulate a certain portion of that hypothalamus that satiates your hunger, for instance, an animal will not eat and will starve to death. On the converse, if you right adjacent to that, if you electronically stimulate a little area that causes you to be hungry, that animal will stay hungry and will continue to eat and continue to eat and continue and never stop until it dies. It is really powerful. Arguably the most powerful area of the brain that there is. And leptin controls it. Now there's a lot of feedback because hunger is so important, it isn't the only control. They're finding a dozen or so hormones that regulate the feeding and hunger area. But still, it appears that leptin is the most powerful, and the others tend to depend on leptin. So what is supposed to happen is, as you get fatter, your fat cells produce leptin, goes to your hunger center, and tells you that you've got enough fat stored. Start burning it, and quit being hungry, and stop eating. The only way that a person will be able to stay away from food, especially in our society, when food is available everywhere, is if they are not hungry. Hunger is a powerful force. And we have built-in mechanisms to obey what we're told to do. And we think of ourselves as free-willed individuals. And I would argue against that. I would say we're not really that free-willed. We do what our hormones tell our brain to do. The signals between nerves, I'll tell you this for yourself, you know, they're neurotransmitters. What are those? They're hormones. Every thought, every desire, every purpose, every behavior that you have is dictated by hormone signals. And the two most powerful signals that regulate feeding and behavior are the signals that regulate hunger and reproduction. The urge for sex and the urge for hunger are the most powerful signals that we have, because they are what allowed life to perpetuate. All of our ancestors gave in to those urges, or we wouldn't be here talking today. If you're told to eat, you're going to find a way to eat. So you can control yourself. You can say, I'm fat, I'm not going to eat. You can do that for a day. You can do that for 2 days. You can count calories. You know, say once you reach 1,500 calories, you can't eat anymore. And you'll do that. And then if you've got a hormone leptin telling you to eat, you're going to eat. It's like holding onto a cliff. It's an analogy I use frequently. You know, you can hold onto a cliff. You can look down 10 miles. You can be on the top of Mount Everest. Look down. You know, if you let go, you're going to die. And you're going to hold on with your as hard as you possibly can. And you will let go eventually, because gravity is unrelenting and so is hunger. And that's why diets haven't worked. And that's why you see these yo-yo diets all the time. You've heard of the yo-yo diet syndrome? People will lose a little weight and then they gain it back. Lose weight, gain it back. If you lose weight, but you still have high levels of leptin, indicating leptin resistance, which I'll describe, which is telling you that you need to store more fat, you will, because you want everything you think about will be food. You'll be thinking about eating when you're sleeping. And you will eat. The only way you're not going to eat is if you don't want to, because you're not hungry. And the only way you're not going to be hungry is if leptin is telling your brain that you shouldn't be hungry, and that you have more fat than you need, or at least enough, and that you can actually burn off some of it. Leptin has to be a clear signal to your brain. So how do people get fat if this is supposed to be working? I mentioned that all disease is a result of miscommunication, or malcommunication, or wrong communication. How many people here have heard of insulin resistance now? The majority of people, that's great. I first started talking about insulin resistance maybe a decade ago, and gave one of the first talks to a whole big group of doctors in Chicago in latter part of 1995, and not one doctor out of the several hundred that were there had ever heard of insulin resistance. It wasn't known at all. Now it's known by to the general public. Insulin resistance is what causes most cases of type 2 adult onset diabetes, which is most cases of diabetes. You got plenty of insulin around, but your cells are resistant to it. It doesn't hear the message. So sugar can't get into your cells to get stored. Insulin lowers sugar as a byproduct of trying to store that sugar as fat, mostly. So it's not really regulating sugar, it's regulating energy storage. But if your cells can't hear insulin, then the sugar doesn't go into your cells and your sugar is allowed to elevate and you get diabetes. But it's not due to a lack of insulin. So giving more insulin allows perhaps the body to yell louder for a little while, but it's only then going to perpetuate the resistance. It doesn't treat the underlying cause of insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is like being in a smelly room. If you're in a smelly room, pretty soon you can't smell it. You become desensitized to the smell due to the strong odor. You basically kind of temporarily burn out your olfactory nerve. Now you can smell it again if you go out of the room. In other words, make that smell really diminish, and then you can resensitize your olfactory nerve so they can smell it again. So if you come back in half an hour, then you can smell it again. If your cells throughout your life are exposed to high levels of insulin, the same thing happens. Your cells become diminished in sensitivity. Pretty soon they can't smell insulin, so to speak. And then they can't listen to insulin. But in most of us, they don't ever get a chance to go out of the room. Every day they're exposed to high levels of insulin because of people's diets. They eat a particular meal that causes insulin to go way up almost every meal. So they're constantly, chronically exposed to high peaks of insulin. And they get more and more and more resistant to the action of insulin. Early on, your pancreas can compensate by producing more insulin. Be the analogous to just pumping more smell into the room or yelling louder. But that only causes your cells to become more resistant faster. And your pancreas will reach a limit as to how much insulin it can produce. It can't continue to produce insulin indefinitely, certainly not higher levels, so it's going to reach a peak. But your resistance is going to climb. Is after it reaches that peak, that could be, you know, typically that took decades, 4, 5, 6 decades, which is why it's called adult onset diabetes. Started when you were 0 days old. Actually, it started in the womb. As your mother ate foods that caused insulin surges, as a fetus, before you were ever born, you were exposed to high levels of insulin, and you started becoming insulin resistant in the womb. And they've showed that mothers who eat a high carbohydrate diet will produce babies who are born on day one with partial insulin resistance, setting you up for diabetes in later life. Does that mean that diabetes is a genetic disease? No. So you can be born with something without it being genetic, by what the fetus was exposed to in the womb. So the treatment there would not be to make more insulin if you've got plenty around. The treatment is to resensitize the cells to insulin. So you don't want to, if a type 2 diabetic, treatment is not to give more insulin. The treatment is to eat a diet that minimizes insulin so that the cells can reacquaint themselves with insulin's signal. And insulin signal, as I mentioned, goes way beyond the control of blood sugar. It's not sugar we're concerned about in diabetes. The big concern in diabetes is the fact that your cells can't listen to a hormone that regulates aging. That's a problem, which is why diabetics get a higher degree of cardiovascular disease, a higher degree of cancer, a higher degree of autoimmune disease now, higher degree of osteoporosis. They get all the higher degrees, higher incidences of all of the chronic diseases of aging because they are aging at an accelerated rate. It's really the aging process you need to slow down. I don't really care about the sugar, other than it's telling me that you can't listen to insulin. And the consequences of that go way beyond blood sugar. You regulate your insulin, you get your cells to listen to insulin, sugar is going to come down. That's a given. But your incidence of cancer is going to go way down. And heart disease is going to go way down. Your propensity to store extra fat is going to go down. And that gets us back to leptin. How do people get fat? Let's say you start getting fat. But let's say your brain can't listen to leptin. Let's say you start getting leptin resistant. Just like insulin resistance. Your brain is not hearing leptin. So it's thinking that you are starving to death. It's thinking you don't have any fat. You're going to be in trouble. You won't be able to survive a famine. So you need to be hungry. You need to eat more and make more fat. So you could be 5'2 and weigh 250 pounds, but you're being disconnected from your brain. Your brain has no idea. Your brain has no idea that you've got 200 pounds of fat being stored on a 50-pound frame. And it's telling you to store more. It's telling you, be hungry, eat more. And so it tells you to keep getting fatter and fatter and fatter until finally you produce enough leptin to get through the block so that a little whisper can get through to your brain saying, all right, I'm a little bit fat. And then your hunger goes away. And so people who get fat don't usually get to, 1,000 pounds. They'll level out at 200 pounds or 250 or 300, whatever poundage is necessary to produce enough leptin to tell the brain that the body is storing some fat. The only way that on a permanent long-term basis you are going to affect a significant change in the amount of fat a person is storing is if you can get that leptin message heard louder. And if you can restore leptin sensitivity, all of a sudden you're having your brain get screamed at by leptin. And your brain is going to hear a message, I'm really fat. I'm way too fat. I'd never survive a lion chasing me. And I need to get rid of some of that fat. And the way you're going to get rid of that fat is be allowed to burn it through the sympathetic nervous system and to not be hungry so you don't keep storing it. And so you become really satiated and you're allowed to dig into your fat stores. And if you dig into your fat stores, your cells are going to eat. I mentioned early on, for a reason, I do not want you to think of your cells as a single individual. You are not. You are a republic of cells. It is your cells that are living. You are a beehive. You are an ant colony. You are a society of cells. It is your cells that eat. When you put food in your mouth, and when you digest food, you're just continuing the refinement and the processing of that food. When a farmer, for instance, has a cow, you know, he'll take that cow to a feedlot, and then it'll go to the, you know, then he'll kill it and chop it up into big pieces, and it'll go to the store and go to the butcher shop, and they'll chop it up into smaller pieces, and then you'll buy it and you'll take it home, and then you'll chop it up into smaller pieces, and you'll cook it, and you chew it, and all you're doing is chopping it up into smaller pieces. And you then, it's absorbed through your intestines, and it'll be distributed through your bloodstream, and all you're continuing to do is distribute that food, just like taking it from the farm to the grocery store, taking it from the grocery store home, taking it from home to your mouth, taking it from your mouth to your cells. It is your cells that will sit down to the dinner table and eat. And your cells can burn sugar or they can burn fat. That is their choice. You want your cells to burn fat. And I am asked if I can summarize in a single sentence. Now, everything I've said so far, like if I were a college professor and I were going to be testing you, you know, I was like when my professor said, this is what I'm going to ask on my test. This is all I want you to get out of today, is what will make you healthy, what will determine your health, and how long you live, is the proportion of fat versus sugar you burn over a lifetime. It's as simple as that. The more fat you burn compared to sugar, the healthier you're going to be, and the longer you're going to live, other things being equal, you know, provided you don't get into a car wreck or something. But as far as nutrition goes, it is the proportion of fat versus sugar you burn over a lifetime. People do not get fat because they eat it. People get fat because they don't burn it. There's a big difference. If you eat fat with sugar, you're going to burn the sugar off first and you store the fat. If you keep doing that, you forget how to burn fat. If you can't burn fat, if your hormones, if you're leptin resistant, for instance, or if you're insulin resistant, they're telling you to store fat and don't burn it, you're going to stay hungry and you're going to crave sugar and carbohydrates because you don't store much sugar and carbohydrate. So you have to keep eating it. At night, if you don't eat and your hormonal milieu is telling you to make fat and don't burn it, that means you have to burn sugar. Where are you going to get your sugar if you're not eating? You're going to get it from your muscle and bone. You can make sugar out of protein easily. Process called gluconeogenesis. Diabetics wake up in the morning and they measure their blood sugar. Where is it? It's high. And they wonder, but I didn't eat anything. Where did it come from? It came from your muscle and your bone. You want to know how you become osteoporotic? That is how. By turning your bone into sugar. The strength of your bone is determined by the protein matrix, not by the calcium. Calcium, by the way, has nothing to do with it whatsoever. That's something perpetuated by the dairy industry. It's the protein. What holds this building up? It's the frame. Think the brick on the outside has much to do with it? Calcium is like the brick on the outside. fact, it can actually impede signaling. I won't get there right now. But you have to be able to burn fat. Now, if you, contrary, have the ability to burn fat properly, if you can listen to leptin, if you can listen to insulin, and your brain can finally detect that you've got plenty of fat around, that you should be burning it, you can dig into your pantry then. Your cells, you, can eat 24/7 without you having to put anything into your mouth, really. They'll have plenty of fuel, and they're not going to make you crave food. You're only going to crave food if you have to burn sugar. Because you don't store much sugar, that means you've got to eat it. You've got to take carbohydrates, you've got to take sugar, because you've got to burn it and you don't have much stored. And you're not allowed to dig into your fat stores. So you've got two ways to be satiated when you become leptin and insulin sensitive. Number one, it appeases a very powerful center in your brain to tell you that you're not hungry. And number two, you're allowed to burn fat so that your cells have something to eat so that they're not hungry either. And that is how you lose weight. That is how you control diabetes. When you are leptin resistant and your leptin levels end up being high, just like they are when you're insulin resistant, and you can measure these pretty easily, not only do you become fat, but you become fat in all the wrong places. We know that when you are leptin resistant, there's a propensity to put fat around your middle, so-called apple shape, visceral fat. It surrounds and permeates your liver. As such, your liver becomes partially deaf. It gets smothered in fat, so it can't listen to insulin. One of the prime messages of insulin is to tell your liver to quit making sugar. When diabetics wake up in the morning and their sugar is high, they got it from their liver. Their liver was making sugar out of protein, which originally came from your muscle and bone. That protein is delivered to your liver, and your liver makes sugar out of it. Now, if your liver could listen to insulin, it wouldn't do that. Only when it can't listen to insulin does it make too much sugar. And it can't listen to insulin if it has too much fat around it. So you get into these vicious cycles. You become leptin resistant, your liver becomes smothered in fat, it can't listen to insulin, therefore it makes too much sugar. You become insulin resistant, and that sugar turns to fat. As that sugar turns to fat in your fat cells, it causes spikes in leptin. And those spikes in leptin cause further leptin resistance. You now know more about health than any doctor that you've ever seen. You can go back and tell your doctors this. Nobody knows this information. And yet it's absolutely vital. But you've gotten certain keys to health right now. And the thing I want you to take out of it is you've got to be able to burn fat. And the only way you're going to be able to burn fat is if you can have proper insulin and leptin signaling. And if you do that, you're not only going to be able to burn fat, but you're going to be able to slow down the damage associated with being one day older tomorrow, otherwise known as aging. And when you do that, you are going to slow down, and in fact, you can easily actually reverse heart disease and osteoporosis and diabetes. It's really not hard to do.
But you don't want people to do it yet.
Right. Now that you know how to do it, okay, I consider this information, you know, so important. I mean, if this stuff was known, and if we could make the proper changes, the incidence of diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure, obesity would take a little bit longer, could be cut in half. Actually, less than half, probably 25%. Cut 3/4 in a month. Worldwide. I mean, I think it actually could go beyond that. Incidence of cancer would go way down. Amazing things can be done to the health of the entire world with very simple changes. But we have to be able to prove it. And the only way we can prove it is by showing, I don't want you to necessarily just take my word for it. Maybe I'm full of BS. You know. But I've been able to show this for a long time. But I want to show it in black and white, and I want to prove it to the medical and scientific community, and we can only do that via lab tests. We can show you. We can measure your insulin and leptin and triglycerides and other things that are important. Cholesterol, by the way, I don't consider to be very important. We could measure it, but there are so many aspects to cholesterol. I suppose I'll mention it now because everybody's going to ask, and I'll just go through just a very, very quick thing about cholesterol. Cholesterol is not your enemy. It is required for life. You need cholesterol. There is no life on earth that can live without cholesterol. It is part of every cell membrane. The medical recommendation to get cholesterol levels as low as possible is the most ignorant recommendation that I have ever heard. It is killing more people than any other single recommendation in the history of mankind. You do not want to necessarily lower your cholesterol. Cholesterol is not only required to make any cell membrane, it's required to make estrogen, cortisone, any of the steroid hormones. It is one of the few commonalities of all life that we know of. There are few elements to life in general that are more important than cholesterol. You don't want to get rid of cholesterol. Is cholesterol associated with disease? Yes. It probably is. But association and cause is not the same thing. It's very different. Cholesterol is associated with disease because cholesterol goes up when you've got disease because it is trying to save your life. It is like, you know, somebody who was in a car accident and a paramedic stops by to try and save that person's life. And then they put that paramedic in jail for causing that car accident, even though he might have just been walking by. That's what they did to cholesterol. When you become injured, you become inflamed. And inflammation is a common mechanism to repair damage. You cut your hand, certain things will happen to allow you to live. You cut your hand, you're going to see swelling. And the swelling is there to, number one, try and stop the bleeding. It's there to try and close the gap so that dirt and bacteria don't get in. The inflammation causes white blood cells to rush to the area. It causes blood vessels to constrict so you don't bleed to death. It causes your blood to clot so you don't bleed to death. And it also causes stimulation of new cells to be manufactured to replace the ones that have been damaged. These inflammatory signals go throughout your body. You just cut your little finger, and though there's an increase in inflammatory signals in your bloodstream that goes everywhere. Some of those inflammatory signals go to your liver. It is your liver that manufactures cholesterol. That's well known. That's not debated. When we measure your cholesterol, it is the cholesterol manufactured by your liver. The amount you eat is almost irrelevant. Okay? That's not really that debated any longer. That was found out 15 years ago. But your liver is manufacturing cholesterol, and when your cholesterol goes up, it's an indication that you've got to repair damage. You've got a lot of inflammation around. So the reason you have high cholesterol is because you've got damage going on that your body is trying to repair. What you really ought to be going after is the damage. Why do you have damage going on? What is causing the damage? Could be too much glucose around, because we know glucose damages tissues. It's a process called glycation. Glucose combines with proteins and causes glam. We know it causes inflammation. A lot of things cause inflammation. Anytime you have inflammation, you're going to have signals going to your liver to manufacture cholesterol to fix tissue. So cholesterol is associated with disease, but in a positive way. And when you lower cholesterol, what you're doing is you're impairing the repair mechanism. While you're augmenting the bank accounts of the pharmaceutical industry. The single product that has made the greatest profit in the history of mankind is what? And it's not Microsoft. It's actually statin drugs. The recommendation to lower cholesterol has nothing to do with health. It has to do with the bank accounts of the pharmaceutical industry. Don't even concern yourself with cholesterol. It shouldn't even be measured in people, other than an indication of disease, but there's better indications of it. And of course we know that there are different kinds of cholesterol. So even if you went by the usual medical thinking, for instance, 20 years ago there was just cholesterol. Then they found out, well, there's good and bad cholesterol, right? You heard about good and bad cholesterol? HDL and LDL. HDL is supposed to be the good cholesterol, LDL is the bad cholesterol. So in some cases, high cholesterol was good if a lot of it was HDL, right? But we know now that you can continue fractionating cholesterol. First of all, cholesterol is just cholesterol. It is only a single molecule. There's no such thing as good and bad cholesterol. HDL stands for what? High density lipoprotein. So what is HDL?
HDL, high density lipoprotein.
It's a protein.
Right.
Okay. It's not cholesterol. It's actually a protein. It's a totally separate entity. And yet we equate it with cholesterol. What does LDL stand for?
Low density
what?
Lipoprotein.
It's a protein. What is cholesterol? It's actually a fatty alcohol. It's an entirely different class of molecule as LDL and HDL. Now we also know that HDL and LDL can be fractionated. We know that there are good and bad LDLs and good and bad HDLs. And only the small, dense LDLs are potentially bad, not even bad. You can have LDL-A, you can have LDL-B, you can have LDL-C. That can all be measured, but it's somewhat costly to do. And it's only LDL-C that could be bad for you if it became oxidized, because it's more oxidizable, and it can cause more inflammation. So oxidized LDL-C is more inflammatory and can cause damage. So just measuring HDL and LDL is worthless. You would need to measure the oxidized fraction of LDL-C. Now, cholesterol is a fat. Fat turns rancid, right? You can't leave fish out on a counter for very long. It'll get pretty smelly. Fat is one of the molecules that oxidizes pretty readily. So cholesterol, which by itself is a vital aspect, not just an important, you can't live without it, but it can become damaged easily and become oxidized, and then it can be bad. Any fat, though, can oxidize and turn bad. Now, what is your brain mostly made of? Fat. Subsequently, what can happen to your brain? It oxidizes. It oxidizes fairly easily, which is why we get a lot of brain diseases. Now, because your brain oxidizes, should we recommend that everybody have their brain removed because it can potentially oxidize? No. Why? Because your brain we consider to be fairly important to your life, right? Okay, likewise, cholesterol can oxidize. But does that mean we should remove your cholesterol? No. We do not want to remove your cholesterol from your cells, because it's required for your cellular life every bit as much as your brain is required for your life. Actually, even more so. The recommendation is a nonsensical recommendation to lower cholesterol with cholesterol-lowering drugs. What I would propose is we are making certain tests available to all of you for as little as we possibly can. The battery of tests that we're proposing would normally run you about $500. If anybody can pay anything, that would be great. Those that can't pay, we're going to do for free. Well, you are all going to become my patients, okay? And there's patient confidentiality, just like every patient. I'm not going to let anybody know. I mean, I'm not allowed to. It's illegal for me to let anybody else know what your labs are.
But on the other hand, the test results can be used as a group kind of portrait of what's happening
right.
to people.
With your permission. You know, only with your permission. You know, if you allow it, you know, we'll just, you know, get averages, I mean, laboratory averages, so that we can maybe use it as a study.
And you also don't want people to be eating totally healthy right now.
Right. Now, that's actually a good point.
Oh, that cheesecake sitting in the fridge.
These, the changes that we're talking about can occur very rapidly. And some of these changes can occur in one day. But big changes can occur in just a few weeks. And we can turn somebody who can't burn an ounce of fat into a really significant fat burner in 3 weeks.
So there's the dilemma, because most of these folks have been experimenting with changing
right.
their diet.
So what I want you to do is just eat like you normally would have eaten, you know, a month ago or a year ago. Just, you know, eat your last supper. You know, just
again. I've
yeah.
been doing that for days.
Good. So this will be the last time that you can do so guilt-free. Beyond this, I'm going to make you feel so guilty. Right? So, you know, go ahead and have your cheesecake. I mean, you know, don't go overboard. Just eat like you would have normally eaten. That's all I'm asking.
I'm Shelley Schlender. You've been listening to a weekly meeting of the Boulder Nutrition Think Tank, launched in 2004. For questions about medications, be sure to consult with your primary care physician. We recommend that whenever you make a lifestyle change, tell your doctor, including about any dietary or supplement changes. The Boulder Nutrition Think Tank is conducted at the Family Learning Center in Boulder, 303-442-8979. Ask for Pilar. To contact Ron Rosedale, check the website therosedalediet.com or call 303-790-8766.